You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Jason Schneiderman. Jason, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it. I'm excited to be here.
First, I just want to ask you, where are you? Are you in Texas at the moment, or where are you?
No, I know I was born in Texas, but I really have not ever lived or spent significant amounts of time in Texas. I'm a military brat, so even though San Antonio is my birthplace and I enter the Texas Book Award whenever I have a book out, I'm actually really as far from a Texan as you can be. If you're a fan of King of the Hill, there's an episode where Hank Hill finds out that he was actually born in New York City. And so I kind of have this like reverse karma with Hank Hill, where even though I was born in San Antonio, I think of myself as a New Yorker now more than anything. And Hank Hill, who was born in New York City, gets to think of himself as a Texan. But no, right now I am in my office. I am in lovely Tribeca at the Borough of Manhattan Community College. Classes haven't started, but I really love my office. I really like having an office to go to, and I'm so grateful that they give me one that I often come in to swear to work, and it's quiet, and someone else cleans it, which is kind of amazing.
Wow, that is nice. So when you say you're a military brat, meaning you were traveling all around in your childhood?
Yeah.
Is that what was happening?
Yeah, so I was born in Texas. We left when I was, I think, like 9 months old. We lived in England for longer than usual, for 6 months. There was sort of a family complication. And then California, and then Maryland, and then Germany, and then back to Maryland. And I do not recommend moving back to a place you have left. That is a very bad idea. And then I got a scholarship to the University of Maryland. And so I stayed in Maryland for college, and then I spent a year in Russia studying Russian, and then I came to New York for graduate school, and I fell in love, and I got married, and it's funny, I sort of felt, do you know that E.B. White thing about the three New Yorks, right? There's like the New York of artists who come to New York to make art, and there's the New York of like people who come on the train to just work in the city and then go home, and then there's the New York of people who just live here, and the New York of the people who just live here is like anywhere else. So I sort of married into the third New York while kind of keeping my feet in the first New York.
I like that. I like that you use Edmund White there too, because that's such an interesting take he has on that. So you're a poet. Did you always, is that how you identify yourself? And have you always wanted to write poetry or
I think I have, yeah. I mean, I wanted to be an actor. I was very serious about acting when I was an adolescent. And I've been writing poetry at least since I was 16. I know that the first poem I wrote was a really bad poem in fifth grade. And my teacher, Hunter Nesbitt, it was this long poem about a key. And like the key was a metaphor for my imagination. And then the last line was like, the key is my imagination. And Hunter, who I'm still friends with, I adore, Hunter Nesbitt is the best fifth grade teacher any human being could ever have. And he said, Jason, I think you're kind of overstating it. Like, you should trust your reader. They know that what you're talking about is imagination. And I was like, no, I think I really need to have it there. And it took me like 10 years to take his advice. But he was right. And I'm really grateful for that first experience of workshopping when I was about, I guess, 10 years old. And then I started writing very seriously when I was 16, and I started writing just for myself in a very private way. And in a certain way, poetry, and a lot of people have this perspective on poetry, and I always have to remind myself that I had it once too, that poetry is a kind of code, that poetry is a way of kind of, you know, encoding your feelings, and that what a reader does is decode them, and there's some kind of system, there's some kind of, you know, ring that tells you what's going on there.
But also the reader, you know, I always think sometimes when I read a great book or a great poem, I feel like this was written for me, almost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, almost like you feel like you possess the poem, like it wasn't just a great poem or a great book. It was kind of like my book, in an odd way.
Oh, that is then you are the right reader. Yeah, that is an amazing feeling. I have that when I see Tony Kushner plays. I'm like, this is for me. This is for me. This understands me. But at the time, I was really kind of hiding. I mean, I was hiding in poems, and I was writing things that if people found, they wouldn't be able to hold against me. That I kind of come from a place where information, I mean, now we sort of live in this time where, you know, information wants to be free and, you know, just be who you are and take the consequences. And I don't, you know, I didn't feel that way. I mean, I kind of needed to be safe. I really needed to kind of hide who I was. And when I first started kind of studying poetry seriously around 1920 in college, and I've been really blessed with amazing mentors, and I started studying with Phyllis Levin at the University of Maryland, I began to realize that I could talk in a way that did make sense. And the other thing about that is that I actually I learned to make peace with misreadings. I learned to understand that I could be talking about one thing and people might be reading it in another way. Because because I'm gay and because I'm Jewish, and I think this is probably less true now, but almost everything I wrote in the 90s was kind of perceived as either being about AIDS or the Holocaust.
Right.
I kind of learned to make peace with that. And I kind of learned to understand that different readers might have different understandings. And it wasn't the same as when I was kind of encoding things. It wasn't the same as kind of hiding. But it was a way of kind of seeing like how the work might be expansive without losing my authorial vision. And I remember right after 9/11 teaching creative writing and students, you know, writing all these things that they thought were so, you know, and I would say something like, well, you do know that in like 10 years, the 9/11 will not be students' primary reference point, right? You do know that like if this poem survives in 10 years from now, people read this. They won't know that it's about 9/11 unless someone tells them. And they're like, no, that's not true. No, everyone's going to, like, you know, like there is a sort of fantasy, I think, particularly when you're younger, that the time stands still, that whatever's happening now will kind of remain present. And so I was really happy. And I don't really know. I mean, no one's kind of revisited my earlier books in a sort of critical way. So I haven't, you know, gotten feedback on how people would receive my earlier work now. But I would be curious to know if people still kind of read those as being about Holocaust and AIDS in quite the same way, even though I was writing very clearly about HIV and AIDS in my first book. My partner is positive, and really a very significant theme in my first book is being a negative person, being someone who does not have HIV, falling in love with someone who's positive. And again, in a very different time. Right now, most of my friends are on PrEP if they're not already HIV positive. And the treatments are just so different and so much better.
So right, the idea of living with AIDS is a different, means something different than it did in the 80s or 90s, because treatments are so different.
Absolutely, yeah. That having HIV in the West with healthcare is very different now. And I say advisedly with healthcare, because if you actually only look at the numbers for men of color, gay men of color in the United States, we are doing worse than many, many countries that we would call third world countries or developing countries. The AIDS epidemic in the United States, but it's a lot less visible right now, because the people who are suffering from it are so much, they're disempowered in a way that a lot of the people in the first wave in the 80s were, had much more access to power. And it's similar with the opioid crisis, right? That right now people who are dying, we have more people in America dying from opioid overdoses than we did of HIV/AIDS in the 80s. But those people who are dying of opioids are really bad at advocating for themselves because of the nature of the addiction. You don't see an analogous organization to ACT UP. You don't see the same kinds of responses that you did in the 1980s. You don't see a David Warner-Rovich or an Essex Hemphill, right? You don't see these
right.
same kinds of figures.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I wonder why not. I mean, you know, in the 80s now it seemed in the
yeah.
art world, the visual art world, as kind of such a special moment. You know, some artists, collectors feel that was kind of a once in a century sort of moment with leaders
yeah.
of that movement, like David Warner-Rovich. It's so interesting that we don't see that, and that the way you're comparing the opioid crisis, you know, I knew it was huge, but right, it was that huge when you compare statistics like that. That's very interesting. So let's hear some of your writing now. What have you been working on lately? Usually the first question I ask.
Yeah, so I'm working on, I'm trying to finish this manuscript, which I don't have a title for. Unfortunately, I had a title, but the title is very close to two very well-received books that came out last year, so I can't use my title anymore. And it's built out of four sequences. And I'm going to read you a poem that's from the sequence about endings. So I have a sequence in which every poem, the first word is last, and then it's the last something. So this is the last war. The last war. The project was simple. Though initially, most people regarded it as misguided. We removed everyone under the age of 12 from every armed conflict. Anyone from 12 to 18 could stay and fight or go, up to them. Adults left in war zones were sterilized, using a gas cloud that could be wafted over battlefields, starving the conflicts of new combatants. Many people were sure that the children, raised abroad by strangers, would continue the conflict. But having anticipated that probability, plans were carefully developed. The adoptive parents were instructed to give contradictory answers, saying things like, oh, wait, no, your parents were Sunni, not Shia, or maybe Sufi? Or, no, I'm fairly sure you were Irish, or was it English? If the children demanded proof, our office created specially forged family trees to show one Hutu and one Tutsi parent, or one conquistador and one Aztec parent, or one Nazi and one Jew. It took a long time, generations, and our critics likened it to genocide or ethnic cleansing. In a way, it was, but every person on the planet watched the last war with great pity. The last two survivors of some ancient conflict, the war zones having gotten smaller and smaller, easily monitored with drones and satellite imaging. The last combatant shot the second to last combatant, and he rejoiced to have won, to have claimed for all his ancestors the piece of land that he would hold until he died under quarantine. He didn't ask to be let out. He knew we wouldn't let him, and so he died, king of his shrunken domain. And after that, we went in, forgetfully, purposefully insistent on forgetting, determined to make no new history, to remember as little as possible. We have destroyed the archives. We have shredded and wiped and erased and burned. We have diaries in which we tear out the pages as soon as we fill them, and on the shelves we store nothing more than empty book covers. We are visionary, we believe, in our belief that there will be no more fighting, as long as there is nothing to fight about.
Thank you, Jason. That was a powerful piece, kind of chilling and also so thought-provoking. You know, it's one of these kind of propositions that sounds like it could work, you know, and
right.
at the same time,
yeah.
You know, so disturbing. I don't know. It's a very complex, idea, I think. Right. I don't know exactly how you're welcome. I mean, it's a beautiful piece, and the idea that you know that we're left with, you know, that there'll be no war as long as there's nothing to fight for. Is that what you said? Was that, you know,
there'll be no more fighting as long as there's nothing to fight about.
Right, and of course that's you know, that's also an impossibility, right? It all sounds like, as crazy as it is, it all sounds probable, and maybe this could work in some kind of slightly altered reality. And that last line, for me anyway, makes it, you know, reminds me that it's an impossibility to avoid conflict.
Yeah, they're sort of not, I mean, for me, a lot of the last poems have sort of been about the ways in which nothing ends. That I have this, I mean, I know that deep down inside me, I have this fantasy that things will be good and then they'll stay good. And that's never true, right? And things get better, but you're never sort of done. Like I have this weird fantasy, which is very persistent, that, you know, I'll get the right job and then I'll be done. I'll write the right book and then I'll be done. That I'll, you know, I'll do something that's right and then it will persist. And I think some of that is from loving art, right? That, you know, like someone like D.H. Lawrence writes Sons and Lovers, or, you know, and you feel done, right? Like Middlemarch, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, right? Like George Eliot did that and it persists. And somehow that kind of came to me in this sort of slightly twisted fantasy of kind of wanting to do something and have it be enough and then leave the world, or sort of to stay in the world in this kind of stasis, which is impossible. And I realized also how much my first efforts at writing were in many ways kind of, it was about the desire to leave the world. And what I've been trying to do is kind of really push myself to use that fantasy as a way to re-enter the world, right? Like if I know that the fantasy is that I can be done and everything will be okay, and I know that's not true, what if I tried to use that fantasy as a way to imagine ways back into the world? And so that's kind of what I hope this piece is doing. And I also, you know, I don't want audiences to entirely know how to feel. I take an incredible inspiration from Kafka. I don't know if you, I feel like this isn't common knowledge, although maybe it is. The Metamorphosis was considered hysterically funny during Kafka's lifetime. But when Kafka read from the Metamorphosis, like, people fell out of their chairs laughing. And now we consider it like one of the darkest, saddest texts.
Right.
Of world literature, right? Like, it's almost impossible to imagine Kafka being funny. Although I will say, if you ever take a Kafka class, like if you're ever actually discussing Kafka after having read it with a significant number of people, it does become very funny. Like the dark humor like really emerges when you start talking about it. And so there's this part of me that has this aspiration to be like Kafka, where you laugh the first time you hear it and then you cry the second time. That I kind of want that push and pull for that really, that landscape, that emotional landscape that's calibrated in such a way that some days it reveals kind of beautiful possibility and some days it reveals just sort of horror.
I like that, you know, and it's such an interesting, that's such an interesting way to kind of, I guess, communicate with your audience, you know, but also what you're saying, the idea of, you know, wanting to do one last thing and then everything will be okay, right? If you have like one great president, everything, you know, will be all right. Or, you know, I have this fantasy of, I don't know, having a certain lifestyle and, you know, I'll wake up and I'll read books and I'll have this, you know, this life of what a writer that I imagine, and, you know, or an artist, and you're sitting and reading and it's something from the movies, you know, that doesn't actually happen.
Yeah.
You're distracted by minutia and a million other things. And, but yet there's this, we still reach for that, right? We still believe that that will happen. And it's, and as that poem really articulated, those, you know, as you're talking about it now, also those things are an impossibility. You talk about using that, the part I don't understand is using that to get back in, using those ideas to kind of, as you were saying earlier, you wanted to always leave the world. And, I don't know if these two completely relate, but, you know, when you let go of this notion or struggle with embracing the notion of the impossibility of there being a last thing or just the right job that sets everything up, What do you mean by using that same thing to re-enter it? Because that sounds kind of like a like an evolution in that way of thinking, as opposed to it being this just I just need the right job or the right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a part because there's been particularly in, I mean, I'm hyper aware of it in poetry land because that's kind of where I live. Even though I think it's also true in the art world and in fiction land and, you know, these various other places, this kind of idea that everything is political, right, that everything has to be political. And a friend of mine was, you know, talking about someone posting on Facebook about, you know, people still watching Woody Allen movies or something and saying, well, I guess they value entertainment more than social justice. And it was sort of like, well, is that just entertainment? Isn't there like a deeper value somewhere in there? And I was thinking, I was at a bookstore, and there was a pin which said the personal is political. And I've been trying to track this down. My understanding is the original phrasing of that in the feminist movement, in the second wave feminist, was the political is personal, which that I believe 100%. Absolutely the political is the personal. If you are making laws, every single one of those laws affects someone's personal life. If you are having politics, they are deeply personal all the time. But is the personal always the political? And that, like I was thinking, I'm going to make a button which says the personal is coextensive with the political in ways which cannot be predicted but must be continuously explored. Right, that's the button I want to wear. I don't think anyone else is going to join me wearing this button. But in a lot of ways, writing these slightly fantastic pieces was a way for me to address that political, right? Kind of if being political is one way of being in the world, and for many people seems to be the only way of being in the world, or at least what I hear them saying is that the only way to be in the world is political. I wanted to see if I could address that without fully endorsing it, right? I mean, for me, so much of what's valuable about poetry, and this is why I was drawn to poetry, is that in prose, I was always very aware of what I wasn't saying. I was very aware of how every sentence contains some kind of lie because there's something next to it that isn't being said, right? That in every truth, there's always like a truth kind of next to it that also needs to be expressed. And poetry felt like the place where you could, because it was so concerned with emotion, that, you know, one definition of poetry is that it's the place where thinking and feeling aren't separate. Right. One definition of poetry is that it's the place where my husband and I say think feel. My husband Michael Broder, the founder of Insolent Books and the author of two wonderful collections of poetry. But we often say to each other, like, you know, I think feel this or that. And, you know, it comes out of thinkers like Audre Lorde, who really insist on the importance of intuition, right? Really insist that thinking and feeling have this incredibly symbiotic relationship. And I've written essays about this, and I've said, you know, if anyone doesn't think that thinking isn't emotional, remember the last time you got a math problem wrong, right? It felt bad, right? That thinking and feeling are not, you know, these isolated processes, but in fact, they're really overlapping. And poetry felt like the place where those things were really recognized, and it felt like there was an audience that was eager to think in that way, right? And that was sort of what drew me to poetry. And you know, in a certain way, those workshops in college were the first time when I felt understood. That, you know, growing up, I had a reputation for being funny. And I think I am funny. I mean, I like to be funny. I'm proud of funny. But there were a lot of times when I would just say things and people would laugh because they couldn't believe that was what I actually thought. So if I would say something like, I still don't understand this, how people can root for sports teams when the players represent a locale they're not from. Like, I totally get how in the Olympics, you know, if you're American, you root for the Americans. If you're Chinese, you root for the Chinese. If you're, you know, Australian, you root for the Australians. Like, that makes sense to me, right? But then, like, the Yankees, those people aren't from New York. How are they New York? Right? But if you say that, like for a long time when I said that, people thought I was, you know, that's just one example. And I would get in trouble in school for sort of, like, the story I usually tell is a playful one, where I had this fight with my physics instructor over the reality of magnetic fields. And it ends up in my first book. It's a poem in there. And now, you know, after a PhD, I would say, oh, magnetic fields have no materiality. But at the time, I didn't have the word materiality, and I was just like, they're not real. Like, they're predictive forces. They're forces, but they're not things. Magnetic fields are a way of describing a force and how it will act on matter, but it is not matter itself. And I remember my physics teacher put, you know, he had the iron, this is a while ago, so there was like overheads. So he put iron filings on the overhead and then put down a magnet. And then, you know, you have that beautiful, which is, and it is beautiful, that kind of figure eight, the sort of concentric figure eights that form when iron is exposed to a magnetic field. And he was like, Jason, like, what would you call that? And I was like, iron filings. That is not a magnetic field. And, you know, just things like that. So I would, you know, he kicked me out. Like, you have to go back to the English department. And it was playful. I mean, it wasn't, but there are other times when I really did get in trouble, when, like, I would just say something I thought everyone was thinking, and they weren't. And then either I was very funny, or I was in a lot of trouble. And then poetry felt like the place where I was like, oh, I can say what I'm thinking, and I'll be valued for it.
That's so interesting, and that of course relates to the poem you read as well. And I mean, it seems that those things should have been allowable in physics. I had a lot of problems in high school with questioning what imaginary numbers really were about and how they could be used in calculations. And
right.
And it was I thought it was fascinating, and I thought it was so interesting. But the teacher ultimately said, you know, figure it out yourself. You know that you know. I think they didn't have answers for them. They were following along with things, but it wasn't that I didn't believe that imaginary numbers didn't somehow help with determining volume, but it also, you know, really didn't seem to make sense either,
right.
Especially in the context of mathematics. And all they could tell me is, well, you have to know much more math to understand, you know, what it's about, and you're not at that level yet.
Right. Can I read you my numbers poem? I have a numbers poem from the second book.
I love that, yeah.
Okay. And I can't remember if this is an actual midrash, which is a Jewish story, or if I made it up. I think it's based on an actual midrash. But it's a midrash about the letters asking to be invented. And so this is my take. The numbers wait with God for humans to invent them. Three said, let me go to them. I'm a magic number. I can teach them man and woman and baby. And God said, they don't know that yet. Five said, they need me. I'm the fingers on their hand. Look how much they lose without me. And God said, yes, they do need you, but they aren't ready. And God smiled and tussled for his hair and picked up two and kissed him on the cheek. The smaller numbers were eager to get to earth, where they were sure they would be loved away from this confining madhouse. Some and none had already gone to earth, and God had told many and few that it was time. The smaller numbers missed their friends and were sure that things were better on earth, even though they knew that the numbers that scared them, a million and a trillion and their sisters dragging their enormous bodies, the imaginary numbers who screamed at night the things they knew, the limping fractions and ratios wandering like disfigured veterans, the shadowy gloom of the negative digits whose faces they knew as their own, they knew that those numbers would come to Earth in time to join them, and that once they had arrived, there would be no escaping them, ever.
Thank you. I love that poem.
That's the only poem that ever came to me complete. It came to me in a dream, and I woke up and I wrote it down. And that was that. I wish that would happen more often. But it only happened once, and that was that poem.
It's fascinating. I'm really glad you read that one, too. Before we go, I usually want to ask one last question about
sure.
what you're reading, but is there something else you want to say about that poem? I don't want to give it too little attention, but it was just such a lovely piece that fit in well with our conversation, and also I think relates to the first one you read in at least your approach.
Thank you. I think that it also has to do with having had a really weird reaction, but also a formative action to a lot of Jewish midrash as a child, and sort of being told these stories, and sort of being like, that's bizarre. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And yet knowing there is like a kind of wisdom to them as well. And for a long time, like, I really pushed back on them. Like, my mother, not quite at the height of the AIDS crisis, but when AIDS was really ravaging the gay community, and I was not in the gay community. I mean, I was in like high school. I couldn't really get to that. I didn't have a lot of freedom. My mother told me this midrash about how humans had asked God for sickness, but it was too distressing for people to just die, and they asked God for sickness so that they would kind of have a way of knowing that someone was on their way to death, that sickness was this kind of human request so that people didn't just drop dead. And I was so angry. And I, I wrote poem after poem after poem about how awful this was. And then I had this weird experience where do you know about like Seder's and Passover where you read the Haggadah
sure.
and you have this sort of like
I'm Jewish. I've been going to them my whole life. Yeah.
Okay. So Seder's are crazy pants, right? Because you read all the stuff that makes no sense. And you're like, well, if there were 10 plagues at the Red Sea and that was the finger of God, the outstretched hand of God was 50 plagues. And you're like, what? And then one year we didn't have it. One year I went to like a very progressive Seder and we didn't read anything crazy. And it was all, kind of like things that we endorsed and ways of thinking that made sense to progressive liberal Jews. And at the end we were like, that was terrible. Like, I want back to crazy. Like, I miss it. Like, that was like that weird intrigue was something that I needed. And that was kind of when I realized like, oh, this is like deep inside me, right? This is a way of thinking that I shouldn't only resist, right? I should embrace and resist. But, like, this is something that I need, that I'm going to miss if it goes away. And so that was kind of what happened with that poem. So what am I reading right now? The thing that gives me the most pleasure, actually, is I read The New Yorker every week, and it makes me really happy. It makes me feel informed, and the writing is beautiful, and I feel like I'm learning a lot. In terms of poetry, I love the new Frank Bidart volume. The final poem about Genghis Khan is just amazing, and I mean, it really matches up with like Ellen West and with the Nijinsky poem, and is just it's a touchstone. I mean, for me, Frank Bidart has so many touchstones, and that new Genghis Khan poem is among them. I just read Dinesh Smith's book, Don't Call Us Dead, and it was an absolute revelation. The way that he's working with language is challenging to me as a writer. It makes me want to be a better writer. It feels like I should be pushing harder to make language do things. I was really... really impressed me. There's this one poem that's in response. I go back a lot to Richard Sykins' Litany. I'm going to get the title wrong. Litany with certain things crossed out. And Dinesh has a poem in response. It's just beautiful. What else am I reading? I go back to Linda Gregerson a lot. I just read Paisley Rekdal's The Broken Country, which I thought was a really amazing assessment of the aftermath of the Vietnam War and Asian American identity and American identity, sort of all people who would or would not hyphenate to American. And it was just really powerful how much empathy she was able to bring to every subject position that she was describing. And in certain cases, there's a point where it centers on a crime, and she never meets with the person who committed the crime. And she says, I actually can have more empathy because I didn't meet him. And I thought that was amazing. She sort of says, if I met him, I would project all these things onto him.
Right.
And keeping him at arm's length is actually a more empathetic position than, say, being across the table from him. And I thought that was really powerful and beautiful.
Jay, I just want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you for reading, and I wish you the best with your next work.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.